Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Thank you very much for all of your thoughts and feedback. Please keep it coming. You can go to the website, theunexplained.tv, designed by Adam from Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, and send me your thoughts about this show. I'm not going to do shout-outs, but I am going to reference one email just before we get to the guest this time. Great guest, Michael Tellinger, returns with lots to tell you, so you've got to listen to Michael in South Africa. He is a remarkable guy. You may agree with him, you may not, but you will certainly want to hear him, that's for sure. An email that I got this morning that was really, really dispiriting. But, you know, I need to get feedback. I've asked for feedback, so I can't be surprised when I get feedback. And I never thought that I was God's gift to broadcasting, and I always think that I need to learn more and be better. That's what's driven me for my entire life. So this morning I got an email from Randy Eckhart in the US, I believe, telling me basically that my Travis Walton interview was garbage because I kept interrupting the man and all the rest of it. Now, we have had this out before, and I do admit that sometimes my enthusiasm will carry me away. And I'm so keen to get to the point or refine the conversation or make sure that we stay on track. Or sometimes the digital technology has a time lag and it sounds like you're interrupting when you're not. You may say excuses, but Randy Eckhart said that particular interview, which was actually taken, I do take a very few items from my radio show that I think you want to hear here. It was taken from my radio show when we were under time pressure to get to the news, so I had to get the story out there. Randy Eckhart said that it sounded desperate. I sounded desperate. And really, that was never the intention. And I'm sorry if I gave anybody that impression. I've had some very good feedback on the Travis Walton show. But, you know, I think you were a little harsh there, Randy. But I'm going to take on board what you said as I take on board what everybody says. And look, Travis Walton was a brilliant guest. I'd like to talk with him again, and I want to have more time for him next time. You know, I think Travis Walton puts a very credible story, and his whole demeanor, I think, is very calm, and for my 2 cents worth, sounds very credible. So, you know, there I am saying what I believe about this. You know, until I hear evidence that it's all a complete fake, and some people have tried to tell me that that's the case, I'm going to take on board a lot of what Travis Walton had to say, because I think it is an amazing story. And do we think such things happen? I think they probably do, and probably have. But then, you know, I may well be wrong. I've spent a lot of my life being wrong about things, so I might be wrong about that. But I loved Travis Walton as a guest, and I'm really sorry one particular person, and there might well be others, felt that way about it. So, you know, I'm going to note everything that was said there. But the difference between this show and some other shows, as I said, I think in the last edition, is that you get some podcasts where the host comes on and says, I've got this particular guest here. Thank you very much for coming on my show. You're a wonderful person. Tell me about your wonderfulness and about your new book. And then they don't say very much apart from, wow, throughout the whole conversation. I'm afraid that's never going to be me. Some things that I hear do make me say, wow. But, you know, I'm here to question, I guess. But I have an open heart and an open mind. And I've paid a price in my life for that sometimes, certainly professionally, but I do. So that's me and where I'm coming from. Sorry, I'm giving you another mission statement now. Please go to my website, theunexplained.tv, if you want to communicate with me. Send me an email from there. Lovely to hear from you. And any guest suggestions that you might have, if you can put in the subject line, guest suggestion, and we'll get on it as we develop this show. Work is progressing, by the way, on the new website, but more about that in future editions, as they say. Let's get to South Africa now, and to a man who's been on this show before. We're going to talk about two things. We're going to talk about some amazing discoveries, and flowing from them, a whole new system of organizing our lives that might be more functional than the one that we have, but you decide. So, let's get to SA. Scientist, researcher, humanitarian, author, and activist, Michael Tellinger is here again. Michael, thank you so much for coming on.
Lovely to hear your voice, Howard.
And how is life then? I understand that these days you are now living closer to the source of your work.
Yes, I gave up life in Johannesburg after I wrote Slave Species of God, and a few years after that, and in 2008, I moved out into the mountains of Mpumalanga pretty much into the heart of the stone ruins or stone circles, which has really become my life. And the research that I've been doing here is just getting more and more fascinating and unimaginably beyond words, mind-blowing. It is definitely, unquestionably pointing to the true cradle of humankind. I'm right in the heart of it. It is connected to the Anunnaki. It is connected to many ancient bizarre activities on our amazingly confusing planet. And I'll share with you some of the latest discoveries that I've just made in the last month in my first ever research program that I initiated, the Stone Circle Research Program. But yeah, it's quite spectacular. And the one most important thing, I believe, that after 10 years of being here, that's finally the penny that's finally dropped for me, is how important this discovery is. What right. a big deal the stone circles are in respect or with respect to all the ancient sites around the world.
Right. And of course, they are related to each other in ways that perhaps we're only just coming to understand now. You know, people like Graham Hancock, yourself, have been working on these things for a long time. But it seems to me it's only just kind of chiming with the public consciousness right now. I mean, you're a very popular man these days. A lot of people want to speak with you.
Well, I've been doing this for long enough now. As Malcolm Caldwell says, you know, I've gone beyond the 10,000 hours.
So you're fully qualified to fly it now. Your description on your website, great website, by the way, Michael, describes you as scientist, researcher, humanitarian, author, activist. That's a pretty big bill of fare there. It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I guess so. And you know, I could probably verify each one of those. And so when I was trying to, you know, just summarize a little bit about for people when they land on my page and have never heard of me, you know, it's I've taken on the banks in the Supreme Court of South Africa. I've taken on the banks in the Constitutional Court. I've taken on the president and the South African Reserve Bank in the Constitutional Court of South Africa. I have started a political party. I ran in 3 elections in South Africa, 1 election in the UK, 1 election in Australia. I've been a musician. I've worked in pharmaceutics. I've written books. I've researched the stone circles. I started the Ubuntu movement as a result of my research, which has grown into, you know, more than 140 countries around the world. So I guess that's in a nutshell how my life has turned out. I've done many things that have all been a platform and a training ground for what it is that I'm doing today.
Right. Well, before we get into what my American friends call the research, talk to me about this election that you stood in the UK. You know, I follow the news here. That's my job. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, that was in 2015. In 2014, we ran in the South African elections. And you know, I used to joke and say, oh, I'm running for president. Mm-hmm. Which was true. I was running for president because if the Ubuntu party would win, I would become president. So...
Well, it, you know, kind of looks like you need one at the moment, but that's a whole other issue.
But I have much better news for you. So, to share with you and your listeners, because of what we're doing with the One Small Town, and this is really the evolution, a 12-year evolutionary process of how the Ubuntu movement came to life, for the reasons it came to life, how it molded itself and started spreading knowledge and consciousness and information about money, the origins of money. Then believed that we could inject a seed of consciousness into the political beast. We got involved there, succeeded on many levels. Because people got to know about us and then realized that we can't change it. It's not going to work. And in fact, by getting involved in politics, we become an opposition party. We start to oppose. We start to become a threat. And that's the last thing we want to do with the Ubuntu movement. We want to unify people, unite people, and not divide people any further than they've already been divided. So it's been an incredible journey. And what we're going to cover in more detail is the current strategy, our global strategy for the Ubuntu movement, which is just taking the world by storm.
Because remember that a lot of people hearing this right now will never have heard that word Ubuntu before. You know, it was a word that you would occasionally hear down in Africa whenever I've been there, but it was not a word that got out beyond there. very much until you started to popularize it. But we'll talk about that a little down the track. I want to get the research done first, because that's important. When we had one of our conversations, it may have been the last one, we talked about the story that we are given at places like Maropeng down there for the tourists, about 50, 60, 70 miles outside Johannesburg, that it is the cradle of civilization. This is where mankind arose. And you were the guy who was standing there more than 10 years ago saying, actually, that's not quite so.
Yeah, it's an absolute lie. You know, they just throw together a bunch of theories and ideas and little apes walking ever more upright and eventually become human. And they say, look, this is the cradle of humankind. And they put the pictures on the wall and people come, the famous pictures of you know, human evolution. The theory of evolution suddenly becomes the fact of evolution. And anyone that studies this will know very quickly that there is no proof that we evolved out of the apes. It's just all long leaps of faith by these evolutionists and have absolutely no proof whatsoever. Once you start going into human history, you realize that we are a clone species. There's no question about it. And anyone that's done any kind of research will be aware of this. So Maropeng is just a very elaborate trick to part of the global agenda to enslave, to keep humanity enslaved and believing in fairy tales and absolute nonsensical scientific black magic. And so that's called the cradle of humankind, Maropeng. And what we now call our place here in Waterfallbuerfen, which is the true cradle of humankind, where the stone circles are, where the Anunnaki were very active. And we have a lot of reasons why I can say that. Scientific, spiritual, and many other reasons as well, by the way. And this is where we could very, very safely say we are as close to the cradle of humankind as anyone could possibly be.
Mm. Now, explain for those of my listeners who are new to all of this, because there are people, it's kind of two audiences that you've got. I'm sure you have this issue all the time. I've got people intrigued and joining all the time, and people, of course, who know exactly what you've just been talking about, the Anunnaki, you know, the bright ones, the gifted ones who were part of our development. But that's been hidden from us for all these years, you say. Just try and explain that in a couple of minutes for people who are just jumping onto all of this.
Pretty much everything that you read in the Bible talks about the Elohim, the Nephilim, the Anakim, the Zamzumim, the Gibberim, the Emim, the giants of ancient times, when there were giants on earth. So the Bible talks about many important historical facts that have been hidden by the scientific black magic institutions that have been imposed on us, pretty much, and you know, turning all that ancient information into fairy tale stories and people just imagining stuff because they can't allow humanity to go there. So they've hijacked us and put us into scientific institutions and told us this is the truth, which is all the hocus pocus nonsense. So when you start studying the Bible and the source and the origins of where the Bible actually comes from, which are the Sumerian texts and the Sumerian tablets, which they themselves claim they had a previous source where they got their knowledge and information from, you start realizing that there was a very different history here on Earth. And the Anunna gods or the Anunna beings, that otherwise known as the Anunnaki, the gods of Earth, Ki stands for Earth, in Sumerian language, and you start realizing that all these so-called mythological stories of the gods and the flying and winged beings and the Vimanas that you get in India and so forth are all actually part of our ancient human history. These are not people's drunken imaginations or mythological stories. This is actually the true history of humanity, and we start to open our eyes to how we've been lied to and deceived by the Eurocentric education system, because every ancient culture in the world will tell you and told the European thugs when they arrived there 500 years ago to conquer their lands. They were told in no uncertain terms that we come from the stars and that we were ruled by the gods. And then the Europeans said, no, it's all rubbish, and replaced all their knowledge with Eurocentric information. information.
Geez, I'm sorry about on behalf of everybody up here in Europe. I'm really sorry about that. I feel partly responsible now, Michael.
Yeah, no, I say that because I'm European stock. Exactly. You know, I can say the thugs from Europe because I'm one of them. I'm a descendant of one of them, and now I'm doing everything I can to fix it.
All right. Now, you tell me that there are exciting new developments in the research. So that is taking you down the track to fixing it. Tell me what you've come out with recently for people who are new to your work.
So for people that are very new to my work, you know, if you want to really get into this, read my first book called Slave Species of God, or the new name of it called Slave Species of the Gods. And that'll give you a very quick introduction, all 600 pages of it, of what I'm talking about. Of the cloning of the human race as a slave race for the Anuna gods or the Anunnaki for their gold mining operations and many other activities that are coming to light as we start studying new mind-blowing translations of the Sumerian texts that are coming out at a rapid rate now as well, especially through the works of Anton Parks. And I can recommend his work to every one of your listeners. It will clearly blow their mind because the truth is much stranger and much more horrific, I can add, than anyone could ever have imagined. So my discovery here was the stone circles of Southern Africa that have been known about for more than 500 years already, and very little has happened or information has been shared about them until 10 years ago when I arrived here in 2008 in the small town of Waterfallbuffen to start studying the mysterious stone circles of Southern Africa. And within the first 2 years, I realized that we're dealing with the largest, and this is what's become such a big deal. We are sitting here in South Africa with the largest cluster or the largest collection of stone ruins found anywhere on Earth. Not just larger, but by far larger than anywhere else on Earth. There are more than 10 million of these structures scattered through South Africa and Zimbabwe.
10 million?
10 million, more than 10 million of these stone circles. So the moment you realize this, you realize that there's a whole part of history that's been completely hidden from us. Because clearly, you know, there must have been a large population over hundreds of thousands of years of people and civilizations that lived here, the Anunnaki. And they came here looking for gold. They found gold and they set up these structures that were not dwellings for people or animals. And this was my other big discovery more than probably 8 years ago now, that the stone circles are actually energy generating devices that were used to generate unimaginable amount of energy by simply converting the subtle vibrational sound frequencies of the earth into very powerful electromagnetic fields.
And that was what you started to tell me. I'm sorry for interrupting you there, but I'm just, you know, I just need to amplify this point. That's what we started to talk about last time we had a discussion. Your work was quite embryonic then, but you know, it's obviously more developed now. It's 8 years or so ago since we last spoke, I think, something like that. You were starting to research the power of sound and how the ancients understood the power of sound.
Exactly. And anyone that does their research into this will realize that sound is the primordial source of everything. All ancient cultures tell us that, you know, that everything was created. God created the universe and everything. You can give God any definition you want. The primordial source of things is sound. Even the Bible tells us, God said, let there be light. It was the sound of the Creator that created light in the electromagnetic fields and the electromagnetic universe we find ourselves in. So the sun, after all, is an electromagnetic phenomenon. It's not a nuclear reactor. Anyone that still believes that is ill-informed and just plain stupid, because they've swallowed the lies of our education system. So,
well, that's going to be interesting, isn't it? Because as we know, NASA has got a probe going to the... In fact, I think it's on its way there, or it's there already. I've lost the plot with this one. Studying the sun. So maybe some of what you've just said will come out from that research, possibly.
Yeah, look, the NASA, Leo, don't start me on NASA, because they are a disciple of lies and disinformation. But in between the lies and disinformation, every now and then they give you pearls of knowledge, the golden thread of truth. They always have to have the golden thread of truth, and then the whole thing is then surrounded by this never-ending pack of lies. So you really go and have to in search of that golden thread of truth, and it's really spectacular. I don't want to diverge this discussion into that, but this is, you know, all this stuff. I go into great detail into all of this in my presentations. And anyone listening to this, please go into YouTube. Just put in my name into YouTube, and you know, dozens and dozens of my presentations will come up, and watch the latest one, especially the one from Sedona, Arizona last year, 2017. It was a 4-hour lecture that was edited down to just short of 3 hours, I think. That'll give you sort of a quick insight into how we've been lied to about mainstream science, the whole particle physics agenda. It's just a never ending, bottomless pit of deceptions. It's ridiculous. But back to the stone circles. So the stone circles are unquestionably very powerful energy-generating devices, just like pretty much all ancient structures, from the pyramids, from the giant temples in Egypt. They were just very large, you know, energy-generating circuit boards. They're not temples for praying or offering or anything like that. That happened much, much later when humanity lost the knowledge of what went down there in the original phase and started using it for all weird purposes, because they were, you know, praying and honoring the gods of the past because they thought they might find favor with them or something like that. Who knows? But you know, I'm not saying that the stone circles are energy devices, because I think so. I know so, because we measure it. We've measured it with very sophisticated technological equipment. We've measured very, very strong sound frequencies in a very high gigahertz, ranging from about 11 gigahertz to beyond 375 gigahertz at Adam's calendar.
That's astonishing. It is, because we're only using those sorts of frequencies in our lifetimes. We thought that we owned that kind of technology.
No, we don't. Anything above 300 gigahertz is extremely well guarded by the highest military secretive operations. And Adam's calendar gives us way more than 375 gigahertz of sound, and converting those sound frequencies into very powerful electromagnetic fields. And Adam's calendar itself is a very powerful toroidal energy generating device that it's just insane. And this is the technology that I talk about in my presentations, the rediscovering of the toroidal fields, or the using toroidal structures and toroidal shapes as energy generating devices. And this is just very important ancient knowledge that's coming back into our reality today.
Well, it's pretty damn mind-blowing, isn't it, Michael, when you think about... I mean, at the moment, I've got a mixer in front of me here and some other gear, and all of this gear now has... It's quite modern stuff. It's got toroidal transformers within it. They are power devices for these things that I'm using to record this sound. But to think somebody had that same technology, the ability to use those toroids, those big coils. Effectively, but in a sort of donut shape. The thought that somebody had that all that time ago is astonishing.
Well, this is the nature of reality. Everything, remember, everything in our reality, starting with sound, it's always sound that manifests first, and then the sound moves, because sound is not static. Sound moves, and then the moving sound creates magnetic fields, and moving magnetic fields create electricity. So there's your very simple three-step explanation of how matter manifests into physical form and creates magnetism and electromagnetism and creates the structure of our universe. Everything is a fractal toroidal field, infinite fractal toroidal fields that are infinitely integrated, from as above, so below. And once you get this, it's very easy to explain anything in our reality and our creation.
But
it's a beautiful. Yeah.
But again, there is a slight delay between us, so I'm sorry if I sound like I'm interrupting. Not really. I'm as enthusiastic about all of this as you are, because we've known each other for way more than a decade now. So this is remarkable stuff. So you have the notion that they had this technology, but do you know what they were using it for?
Yeah, this is the whole thing. So remember that we have thousands and thousands of these donut-shaped stones that are scattered throughout Southern Africa. And these were the energy devices that were used by these gods or the overlords or the slave masters, if you want to call them that. They were used as the energy devices, like the kings and the pharaohs in Egypt used their ankhs, very similar kind of technology. But the toroidal donut-shaped stones are infinitely more powerful. Actually, not necessarily true. Different kind of approach, but that'll launch me into a different discussion. So the Ankh works very differently from the toroidal stones here. But the torus stones here were used extensively. There are hundreds of thousands of these donut-shaped stones left behind by the Anunnaki and possibly other beings that used that as technology to generate energy. And then they used that energy for whatever else they needed. Then they also used the cone-shaped tools, which I've reintroduced the knowledge of the cone-shaped technology to the world, which is ancient knowledge. All ancient cultures use cone-shaped tools to create sazer beams, not laser beams, sazer beams, sound beams, which are far more powerful than laser beams. And, for listeners that are listening to this that don't yet know that sound is a primordial source of everything, that means that sound travels faster than the speed of light. In fact, sound in the zero point travels infinitely fast because the density of the vacuum or the zero point or the morphogenetic field or whatever you want to call it, the density of that source from which everything comes is infinite. It's infinite density. So in an infinite density, sound travels infinitely fast, or resonance and frequency travels infinitely fast. So this is all very important basic information that one needs to understand how things manifest into physical form into our reality and take on these 3D shapes that we then think are physical form.
Was this technology used to create the stone circles?
This technology was used, the sound, no. Sound was used to create the stone circles because it's the subtle frequencies of the earth that create the cymatic patterns upon which the stones were then laid to represent the cymatic shapes of the sound, like sand on a metal plate. When you put sound, a speaker under a metal plate, you put sand on a metal plate or rice or whatever, it creates these beautiful, perfect, not necessarily perfect, it creates these beautiful shapes that, and every frequency has its own specific shape. That's called prime resonance frequency. So everything resonates at its own specific vibration. And this is why every stone circle is just the representation of the sound frequency that comes out of the earth at that space, at that particular place. And by packing the stones on top of that cymatic shape, you then amplify, use the quartz in the stone, silica, quartz, silicon-based technology being implemented here. Okay, I hope people realize that this is what we're dealing with here. Very ancient, basic silicon-based technology using the quartz in the stone that then pick up those sound frequencies that come out of the earth. They amplify it, and the sound starts to travel in the walls of these stone circles and starts to move because sound never stands still. It always vibrates or moves or travels. And so it starts to move in the walls of the stone circles, and that movement of the sound then creates the magnetic fields, and then the magnetic fields, because they move, create the electromagnetic fields. So this is a spectacular thing that we're dealing with here. And we're dealing with clusters of these stone circles that are all connected together by channels that cover 100 square kilometers. This is not a small area, you know?
So this is an organized society, a very organized society using, we think we're so smart because we've got the internet and we're talking on it now. These creatures of that time, these beings of that time, actually, and those who served them, had a technology just as good, if not better, greater than what we're using now.
Oh, infinitely more advanced. We're really just scratching the surface. Remember, we're still using technology because we're stuck in this capitalist system. And capitalism will not allow new technology to be released because that's going to destroy capitalism. So corporations restrict knowledge and information, like a cure for cancer will never be released until we get rid of money, because that's going to destroy the pharmaceutical industry. And, free energy will not be released unless we get rid of money, because that's going to destroy the energy companies and so forth. So and this is where you suddenly see, this is really important for people that are listening to this. This is where you suddenly see the rise of the Ubuntu movement from my research, when I realized that in ancient times, money did not exist And everything was done for the benefit of humanity, or the enslavement of humanity, complete enslavement, by a group of beings that didn't have money, didn't use money, and they did everything for their own benefit. Mm. And then you suddenly see the appearance of money by the royal priests and the royal kings, that the first royal bloodlines that were descended to earth from heaven, as we read in the Sumerian tablets, and suddenly the kings appear from nowhere, and these first kings become the first bankers, their temples become the first banks, and they're the ones that issue the first forms of money, just overnight, start to control humanity through this thing called money. And we realize that it was imposed on us as a slavery system. So to come back where I've just rushed off to, you realize how, as long as we have the corporate structure that's been imposed on us, the capitalist system that we were told is so good for us, that is the slavery system. Because that will never allow progress and people to, and inventors and creative people to be able to express their full potential, because capitalism and money will always destroy our highest gift and our highest creations.
Well, look, you know, I'm not going to argue too much with you about that, because you know, I've seen in my little life examples of plenty of that kind of thing. And maybe people are coming to realize that they need to wake up somewhat. You know, whether they follow your line of thought or not, maybe a certain amount of waking up is required. Bring me back then to the society, if we can call it, in its purest form, that was using this technology, was able to communicate. It seems to me that it was great to be one of them, one of the people at the top, but not so great to be one of those who served them.
Yeah, and this is the terrible truth that we have to face as the human race, that, you know, we're not an evolved species by this you know, lovely story of the Garden of Eden and all that kind of nonsense. Yes, there was a Garden of Eden, but it was not the way that people have turned it into. The Garden of Eden was the Anunnaki's Garden of Eden, where the Anunnaki lived and they had abundance of food and abundance of everything. And they brought the species that they created in there, and actually the species caused disease. That's another long story. I'm digressing a bit. But so absolutely, the Anunnaki, or the Anunna gods, as the Sumerian tablets talk about them over and over and over again, and we're dealing with Enki, which is really the creator, the geneticist, the guy that fashioned this new species, and many other species. There was a whole gang of them that were geneticists and very advanced scientists. They had an acute knowledge of genetics, because this is how pretty much everything in our reality is created.
But they're not still here. I mean, they sound to be remarkably intelligent, amazingly foresighted, if that's the word, but they're not still here. How come?
Well, they may still be here. Just because we don't see them and interact with them doesn't mean that they're not here. There are many parts of the world that are unexplored. We can't get there. So there's still a good chance that some of the Anunnaki are still here. Whoever is running this planet and pulling the strings of the politicians, the puppet masters, we don't know who's running the world. Somebody is clearly running the world, because our governments are not doing what we want. They're doing what somebody else wants. Mm. So, and, you know, we elect them as our servants, and yet they're serving some unseen puppet master somewhere. So this is pure slavery, and the Anunnaki were the guys that created the system. So they created this slave species, and at one stage it went all horribly wrong. And we can't imagine what happened. There were conditions and circumstances over hundreds of thousands of years that we can't imagine. And here we are today, trying to put the pieces together of what I call the terrible truth. It is much worse than any science fiction movie you've ever seen. It is like we're right in the middle of a Star Wars movie, and we're the main characters.
How do we relate to the slave species then? Us, you, me.
What do you mean, how do we relate?
Well, I mean, in what way are we part of them? Are we descended from the slave species?
No, we are it. We are the slave species.
I had a feeling we were going. That's exactly where we're going. Oh, no. That's bad news, isn't it?
No, it's bad news. And this is also where, you know, where the different race groups come from, you know. No scientist can give you a definitive answer why we have different race groups on this planet. If Adam and Eve were all the same race and the same, why, at which point does a blue-eyed blonde couple in Scandinavia suddenly give birth to a black baby? Or at which point does an African couple give birth to a blue-eyed blonde baby? It's not going to happen. So, You know, if anyone is trying to justify that, they don't understand genetics, and they're absolutely brainwashed by the education system that's been imposed on us. So the race groups are clearly very distinct moments of genetic manipulation throughout a very elongated history that's been we've been manipulated on so many different levels, you know, and it's just insane. And it's all about the gold. You know, the big question is what were the Anunnaki after? And, you know, before you even ask that question, I know many of your listeners are probably thinking this. So they came to this planet looking for gold. And it is pretty much their drug. You can call it their drug. It was their drug that gave them longevity, pretty much eternal life. There are very many other reasons and circumstances that they did come to this planet. And you know, I'm just looking at this book sitting on my shelf, and it's called ER101, all about Enki. Enki's other name is Ea, E-A. And then you look at the name of our planet is ER, uh-huh. Earth. Okay, it's the planet of Enki. It's even in our modern language. And when you start breaking down the language and you realize how the Sumerian language is the root language of all languages on earth, including Chinese, Japanese, Arabic, every language you can imagine. Sumerian language is the proto-language of every single one of them. And the Sumerian language is a direct descendant of the Anunnaki language. And the guy that really shows this in great splendor and complexity and clarity is Anton Parks, a French researcher who's done unbelievable work in this area, way beyond anybody else's work or comprehension of what's going on here.
If the Anunnaki are still around, but not in plain sight, if they are somewhere in some form, surely they would take a view on the way things have gone for us. And by any analysis of it, we've already been there in this conversation. You know, things are not going swimmingly well for us here.
No, we're on a slippery slope to complete destruction. So there seems to be two very diverse plans for our planet. One is absolute destruction, and we're certainly feeling the brunt of that. I mean, we're under attack from every possible way. If you think about every day you wake up, you face toxic water in our taps, toxic food on the shelves of the supermarkets, GMO seeds that we can't even buy seeds that'll feed us. The food that the farmers grow is GMO, toxic food. They're spraying us with chemtrails. They're giving us all kinds of diseases. They're injecting us with vaccines that cause diseases, death, and destruction. We're under attack from every single possible area. We're under attack by the news, psychological warfare against us on every time you turn on your TV channel. It's psychological warfare. It's psychological warfare against our children when we send them to school with brainwashing and indoctrination of absolute nonsense and lies about everything from science to history to astronomy to religion. Everything is a lie. It's quite spectacular, you know.
Well, you make it sound like it's all part of a big conspiracy theory. So you really think there's one big plan out there? I mean, you are not the first to say this. Let's put it out there.
Well, if you disagree with anything I've said, then, you know, please be my guest and say, well, you know, it's not. Well, we face this every day. So that is the one thing that's very visibly going on. Most of us are trapped in this rat race, trying to survive, holding down a job, realizing that things are not right, that it's awful. Most people hate their lives. They hate their jobs. They want to escape. They want to find a beautiful life, have a beautiful life and a utopian life where they can express their creative talents and be free and actually enjoy life, but they don't know how to get there. Mm. They don't know where the answers and solutions are. This is where the Ubuntu movement comes in. I'm not going to go on that bandwagon now. Just go online and watch one small town video and you'll get a big smile on your face.
Well, I'm very keen to do that, but in a few minutes, I just want to cap off the research here and where you're at right now.
Yeah. So, and then the other side is that through movements like Ubuntu, Zeitgeist, Venus Project, New Earth Nation, the Thrive Movement, and many other movements like this, I'd like to say that the Ubuntu movement is probably spearheading this right now because we have a plan of action. We have a solution. And we're not just talking about it. We are doing it. We've gone through 12 years of evolution growth and very painful growth and realizing how simple the solutions are. Like everything in nature is really simple. In science and nature, which are all the same thing. And if it's not simple, then somebody has messed with it. And we've realized how simply we can change the current paradigm, create a new beautiful utopian future, a new system for us without any violence, opposition, or conflict, by simply creating a new paradigm, a new system, by making this one obsolete.
Well, you say that simple. We will get into this conversation in a couple of minutes, just to bring us to the back end of the research, because that's important. So you have these findings, and I suppose you're lucky in Africa because the evidence is not going to be as disturbed as it would have been up here, where we've had the Industrial Revolution and we've been building stuff, constantly building stuff. So at least you know, a lot of it is preserved for you to find. But now you're at that point with the research. What are you going to do with it?
Well, what is happening is that it's just opening the hearts and minds and imagination of millions of people around the world. It's allowing them to go to new areas in their thoughts and their imagination where they weren't prepared to go before. You know, we now have the latest finds are fossils of giants, fossils of extinct reptilian beings or animals. You know, I have ribs of giant creatures or beings. I have body parts. I have hearts. I have lungs. I have toes. I have thigh legs. I have shoulder blades. This has all happened in the last month of research. This is brand new mud fossil evidence that cannot be disputed. It is mind-blowing beyond comprehension, and it is quite possible that we might have some Anunnaki body parts here, which is going to be just insane. So I'm in the process of having some of these analyzed genetically, and yes, it is true. You can extract genetic material even out of fossils, so I'm really looking forward to this process for the next month or two, how this is going to unfold.
Problem is, for mainstream science, it might be easier for them to diss what you're saying and what you come out with, because you're a nice long distance away from most of them.
Well, you know, they can diss me. The proof is here. No one can diss the proof. People can come to my museum and see it, and many people do. More and more people are coming to my museum. In fact, I just have I've just had news last week from the Mpumalanga government. Mpumalanga is a province that I live in. The Mpumalanga government that is so excited about my discoveries and findings that we are in the true cradle of humankind, that we got ancient fossils here. They want to start promoting my museum as a destination point for their major international tourism drive in Europe.
Well, that's superb. And, you know, the infrastructure's going in Mpumalanga. I know this. They're improving the roads up there slowly, bit by bit. So maybe more people will get to see what you have.
Yeah, and remember, I'm half perfectly positioned. I'm the perfect halfway stop to the Kruger Park from Johannesburg International Airport.
You sold it to me. It is fascinating stuff. Let's get on to Ubuntu now, because this has been very much a part of you for more than a decade. Now, as far as I'm aware, my knowledge of that word goes back probably, 15, maybe 18 years. And I heard somebody use it on one of the radio stations there. I think it was 702 out of Johannesburg, but it might have been one of the others. And I thought, that's a great word. It has a real nice sound to it, real musical sound to it. And they explained it as a kind of fellowship, a kind of, you know, partnership, fellowship, whatever. And I thought, that's a great concept. I didn't entirely understand it. But you have taken this forward, yeah?
Yeah, well, it is. As you say, it's an African word that pretty much everyone in Southern Africa knows. In other parts of Africa, they have different words and different names for it. And on all ancient indigenous people of the world have a name or a word for this in their own language, in their own culture. And Ubuntu basically means people living in harmonious communities, looking after each other, caring for each other, supporting each other. And that's it, creating prosperity and abundance for everyone. And that's really our payoff slogan is, you know, unity and high consciousness, creating a new world of prosperity and abundance for each and every single one of us. So the Ubuntu movement really arose out of what I mentioned earlier when I was writing Slave Species of God, and I realized that there was a time that money didn't exist. And I started to research, well, what would happen if you took money out of the system? And the more I looked into it, and the more I started to question it and struggle with it, the more I realized that that things become a lot easier and a lot simpler, and we achieve a lot more, a lot quicker, if we remove money from the system and we start cooperating and collaborating instead of competing. And I realize that the whole competition is a structure of capitalism to create division, to create scarcity, to create control, to create a pyramid hierarchical structure, to create compartmentalization of knowledge and information. And the moment you create cooperation and collaboration for the greater good of everybody, all of those negative things fly out of the window. And suddenly you have abundance on every level, whether it's food, science, technology, healthcare, anything, arts, culture. It just explodes with the infinite potential of human creative talent.
Which I'm sure looks a great prospect from down in South Africa. But, you know, up here in the Northern Hemisphere, where, you know, the Yankee dollar, the mighty dollar is king, and the British pound and the euro at whatever state they're all in at the moment, you know, it is going to take, to be able to achieve this, a mind shift of astonishing proportions. And I doubt, without some kind of cataclysmic happening beyond the political system and the commercial system, whether people will begin to really give this idea the traction that it perhaps needs. So, you know, it's going to take an event, isn't it? It's not just going to take theorizing.
Well, I'll tell you right away that you're absolutely wrong. 100% wrong, because we're not just talking about it. As I said, we're doing it. And the 12 years of evolution has taken us to realize that we can't fight the system. We can't oppose anyone. That's all old paradigm thinking. Any kind of opposition, resistance, or conflict, or protest, it's old kind of thinking. Let's just leave that behind and do something that's never been done before. So this is where we came up with a one small town can change the world, or one small town will change the world strategy. And it's simply, basically what it does, it uses the tools of enslavement as tools of liberation. It is a spectacular twist of a twist of reality, because pretty much we use everything that's been shoved down our throats as a control system, but we change one thing. We change cooperation, and we turn competition into cooperation and collaboration. And we use the current political structures without getting involved in politics. We go and we use the mayors to start implementing this plan. Now, we have already around the world two mayors that are implementing it, and probably 20 more mayors that are standing by. Within less than 1 year, within 7 months of launching the One Small Town strategy in January 2017, by July 7th, 2017, I had my first mayor meeting with Ron Higgins from North Frontenac, Canada. And by the 3rd of November, he officially launched the One Small Town contributionism strategy. So the Ubuntu contributionism model, and I created the word called contributionism, a system where people contribute their skills and talents for the benefit of everyone in their community, and everybody benefits from the collective, not just from what they contribute. And so we have a one small town developing so quickly in North Frontenac, Canada. Ron Higgins is putting out regular updates. It is exploding. He is getting phone calls from mayors all over the world, from the USA, Canada, Australia, Germany, UK. I have three mayors in South Africa that want to talk to me about this. In fact, tomorrow morning, I'm driving across the border to Swaziland to meet with the mayor of the second largest town in Swaziland called Mancini, who called me on Friday, said, "I love what you're doing. I want to meet you. I want to talk about this one small town strategy." So this is a domino effect that is just beginning to happen, and I predict that by the end of this year, we might have thousands of towns doing this.
Listen, in my life, I'm well used to being wrong about things, but maybe I'm not entirely wrong when I say something cataclysmic is going to have to happen for people to take these ideas on board. If you look at your own country, and, you know, your own country is by no means unique. We know, and we don't have to name any names or talk about any specifics, that we see people, a lot of good and well-motivated people, and a lot of politicians who've got their hands in the public pocket, politicians and leading figures with their hands in the public pocket. Now, that could be the storm that actually gives your ideas the traction that they need. So it's not entirely wrong to say that it might take an event or series of events to make your dream possible and reality.
I think Hugh, what you're saying is that, you know, I'll tell you what, the one thing I found, and I've traveled through many countries, I've done these workshops and presentations in I think more than 25 countries, and I've done them a few times in the UK, in Ireland, all over Europe, in the USA, Canada, Australia, Czech Republic, you know, Spain, Italy. I mean, I've been everywhere, Brazil. And the response is always the same. Everyone everywhere is miserable. Everyone everywhere hates what's going on in the world. People don't like at all what's going on in the world. And just because they live in London or the UK or the USA or Canada doesn't make them happy with the system. They might earn a few more dollars compared to to people in Africa, but that still doesn't give them any kind of sense of security or belief that they're going to have a beautiful life. They're still miserable about what's going on, and they have no idea how to get out of it. Until they discover Ubuntu, the Ubuntu movement, and they find our One Small Town strategy. And once you've watched this 4.5-minute video, it's just called One Small Town Can Change the World. You watch that little video, it'll put a big smile on your face, and you realize, oh my God, this could be so simple. And like I've just explained to you, I think I can say with certain amount of confidence that the domino effect has begun. It is not that rapid yet. But I know what it's going to take for this domino effect to become a global domino effect, and that is the first day or the first week that we install our alternative energy supply. Remember, we have what we bring to the mayor of the town is an alternative supply of electricity, which is brand new technology. So we can provide any size from 1 megawatt to 200 megawatts electricity for any size town or city. Now, I'm not going to go into detail. Please don't start asking me about details because it's going to hijack this conversation.
But have you got? I'll just ask one quick question. Have you got working models of this technology?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be talking about this unless I was 100% confident that I've seen it, I've touched it, I've used it. It's real. Okay.
But hearing that, then I'm very worried for you because there are some vested interests who are not going to want you doing that.
Well, it's too late, buddy.
I don't
control that technology.
Hey, listen.
It's already going into North Frontenac. It's going to be going into an Australian town soon. It's probably going to be going into a British town. We already have mayors in England that reached out to us. I'm not going to name any names because I don't want to, you know, upset their thing.
This is a revolution, then. It is definitely, it's a quiet revolution. Because, look, you get no argument from me whatsoever. And people say, oh, Howard, you sit there and you do your BBC-style thing and you balance everything out and you play devil's advocate. You know, there's no doubt about the fact that whether you're in South Africa, whether you're in Southampton in the UK, wherever, there are millions of people who are peed off and ripped off by the system, and they have had it. Now, you know, there's me nailing my colours to this mast. That's what I believe. I'm not sure what we do about it, but I like the sound of what you're saying.
And the beautiful thing about this is that the mayor, so now we go to the mayor, and the mayor says, listen, I've had enough. I don't know what to do. My back is against the wall. I need to find solutions for my problem for this town. And we bring them the solutions. And it's very simple. Please go online and watch the One Small Town video because I don't want to go into the detail here. It's so simple. It is unbelievable.
Okay. Well, your enthusiasm is amazing.
I called you Hugh there for a second.
You call me whatever you listen. Believe me, people call me a lot worse than Hugh. So don't worry about that for a nanosecond. Okay, now there will be people, though, who will say, and I'm saying it now, that the thing that might thwart this, and I sure hope it doesn't, is human nature. All systems eventually evolve or throw up leaders.
Let me stop you there, Howard. One of the 13 frequently asked questions, human nature. Human nature is going to destroy this. I've heard this thousands and thousands of times.
But all systems throw up leaders, and all systems throw up people who want a bigger slice of the cake than everybody else. And that's the worry, isn't it?
It's not really. Once you see the One Small Town model, you realize that aspect, it cannot enter that new equation. It's the old paradigm that you're dealing with, because we're now creating a system in which everyone is absolutely equal. Everyone's contribution is regarded and treated absolutely equally. Everybody has access to everything they need, whether it's healthcare, technology, anything you want is available to you because you are part of the contributionist system. You're contributing, so everything is available to you. For those that are new to this, please watch the One Small Town, and within 4.5 minutes, it'll clarify everything. But the key thing that I mentioned is the electricity, because we bring our own source of electricity. That means the mayor has to do one very important thing. The mayor has to find a way to unplug from the national electricity grid and get the necessary permissions to create and provide their own supply of electricity. That means that the town and the electricity belongs to the people, and not to the mayor or the municipality or the council. The electricity supply belongs to the people. Our energy partner will only install the electricity with the condition that it belongs to the people. And therein lies the rub. There's the difference. And it's not a little electricity unit that everyone puts in their house. It's a giant electricity unit which allows everyone to get free electricity. So everybody gets electricity, whether you're rich or poor. And that is a very, very important stabilizing and a balancing platform upon which we build the new infrastructure of that town, with the mayor being the face and the marketing tool and implementing the strategy, being the voice of good news that has not happened for a long time. No mayor has got any good news anywhere in the world. They constantly bring bad news and worried about how they're going to make ends meet. Suddenly, the mayor is the voice of new, exciting developments. Let me tell you one. For example, Ron Higgins hasn't even got his business plans for the new community projects, which, by the way, when I say projects, I mean businesses that are owned by the people and the investors, and it's managed by the council and the mayor on behalf of the people and the investors, right? He hasn't even launched his financial plans, and he's got 13 investors waiting to invest in his town with millions and millions of dollars.
In the model, and that's very impressive, but in the model then, who holds the mayor and those around the mayor to account, just to make sure that they are doing what they're supposed to be doing?
At the people. So what happens is, when you read the Ubuntu book or watch any of the videos and the workshops, and I really recommend people that are new to this, that resonate with this message, go online, get a copy of the Ubuntu book, watch the One Small Town, and watch some of my workshops online. There are many of them. Watch the most recent one, because it'll probably have the most recent information, because they've evolved over the years. They've evolved, obviously. Right. So watch a recent one, because some of the old ones might be confusing, because we are still talking about politics and so forth. So what happens in the town is that the people vote for a council of elders. They actually appoint their own council of elders, and the council of elders keeps an eye on the mayor and so forth. But remember that this happens in a town. The mayor has decided to do this. So the mayor becomes a hero of the people. Ron Higgins is the hero of the people. He gets thousands of emails from people around the world congratulating him, telling him that he's the new savior of humanity. So can you imagine how good that makes him feel? This has not happened to any mayor anywhere.
He sounds like a very good man. But what happens if your system throws up a character like Adolf Hitler, who was a popular leader, and look what happened there?
Well, that's not going to happen, because the moment you start going against the system, I call it a self-correcting system. It always corrects itself for the best outcome for the whole community. You can't spoil it. It's impossible. So you realize that once people start contributing, so remember that what the system requires is that everybody contributes a few hours a week. We've set it at 3 hours a week. Everybody contributes 3 hours a week to one of the projects or businesses or community projects. It's managed and allocated by a central system that is created with people's skills and talents, and it's very easy. The technology is there. It's not rocket science. And as long as you've contributed your 3 hours a week, you then have access to whatever we create in our town. And we create it in abundance, because now we have a free labor force of 10,000. Let's take a town of 10,000 people, which is a really good sized town to do this in, between 5 and 10,000 people. If 10,000 people give us 3 hours a week, that's 30,000 hours of labor every week. You know how much you can create with 30,000 hours of labor a week. You've just become a competitor to every large multinational corporation as a small little town. We can build supercomputers. We can create, we can build a super hospital that cures cancer, because we know how to cure cancer. We can create new technology that does not exist anywhere else. We will create whatever the hell we choose as a collective, because we now have the opportunity to do that. And the best part is that the investors are queuing up to invest in this. Why?
Well, yeah, so why would investors who are from the other side of the tracks, I mean, the old capitalist system, if we want to call it that, why would investors want to put money in, want to put backing in?
That is a really important question, and I was about to give you that, because just realize this. Suddenly, you as an investor, you come into a small town, and you say, right, I want to invest in the bakery. And that's it. There's going to be one bakery that is owned by the investor and all the people in the town, including the baker. Now, suddenly, you grow your own wheat, you grow your own maize, you grow your whatever it is you need to run a bakery. So very soon you'll have your own components and ingredients that you'll be supplying for free because you're growing it yourself. Everyone is on your side. You have a free labor force. You have everyone making sure that your bakery succeeds because they are co-owners of that bakery. You don't have 20 bakeries competing with you. Can you see how quickly we've changed this around?
But look what happened. You're going to hate me for saying this.
This is why the investors are queuing up, because they know that they're going to have no competition. They're going to have all this amazing labor force. They're going to have everyone working to make this a success. And they can export as much milk, cheese, bread, computers, whatever it is they choose to do, and become a global competitor from a tiny little town.
You're going to hate me for saying this, though. You know, we had that in communism where there was one brand of really awful toothpaste in Russia and one brand of bread and one kind of car.
Don't even go there. Howard, don't even go there. This is not communism. This is not socialism. This is not fascism, not capitalism, not anything. This is a whole new ism. It's called contributionism.
Well, look, nobody wants this to be more so than I do. I think it sounds great. And to tell you the truth, I think a lot of things that happen these days, and here comes me expressing my opinion again, stink. You know, whatever people think about that, they do. And we see examples of it all the time. So we need another way.
Capitalism and communism are the same system. One is just a fast track to complete control, and the other one is a slight detour to complete control. Communism is a brutal dictatorship that controlled people, took all their rights away, and turned them into slaves. This is completely the opposite. This gives people absolute freedom. It allows them to express any kind of creative talent. And just remember, again, you know, you're doing the right thing. You're throwing all these things at me because I've had these things thrown at me for 12 years now. I've heard this hundreds of thousands of times.
No, well, exactly. And look, it's a wonderful idea, but the problem is there are vested interests. And if I was the CEO of a big corporation, then I would want to stop you. In the nicest possible way.
Well, how are you going to do that, Howard?
Well, how do big organizations stop upstarts? How do they do that?
Circumstances. This is not an upstart.
No, all
this
right.
This is not an upstart. Right. You're talking about a political structure from the mayor down now implementing a new system to create prosperity and abundance for the entire community. This is not an upstart or a new little company or a business starting up. This is a powerful political unit that is voted in by the people. And if the government doesn't like what's going on, if the government feels threatened and they go, oh my God, that mayor is doing all this good stuff there, we better get rid of that mayor, what's going to happen? What are the people going to vote for? The people are going to vote in another mayor that's going to do the same thing.
Somewhere north of London, there's a little community. I saw it on the television 6 months or so ago, and I'd never heard of this place. I can't even remember its name now. But it was a community that I think was conceived in the 20s or the 1930s. You might even be aware of what this is more than I am. And it was a bunch of people who got together to cooperate. It still exists, but they're having trouble attracting members to it. And it didn't become any bigger than that.
Yeah. So what you're describing, it's one of the common questions that people bring up. Now, remember, what you're sharing with me are the questions you bringing up, or the frequently asked questions, or the hiccups that people have, and I've heard them thousands, probably dozens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of times over the 12-year period, and the answer is always very simple. You're talking about intentional communities. They don't work. An intentional community is actually a huge problem in our society, because it's like people creating a little island within a shark. It's like having a little lifeboat in the shark-infested water. You know, the moment you leave your life raft or your cage, you get eaten. So it's not a solution. What happens with a one small town is, remember what I shared earlier, we use the tools of enslavement as tools of liberation. Now, because we're using the politically appointed mayor, so we're using politics. We've hijacked the political system to work in our favor. We're using the capitalist system. We're using money, existing money. We're not creating an alternative currency where they can't arrest us for doing anything illegal. What we're doing is we're turning our town into the most successful capitalist model that has ever been implemented in a small town. So we're going to make so much money in our little town that we won't know what to do with the money. And remember that every month, one third of the profits, it gets distributed to all the people that participate. So very soon, the more successful our businesses and companies and farming and so forth becomes, the more money we distribute. And very soon, people will be receiving more money every month from the distribution of profits than they are getting in their jobs. What is the next consequential thing that will happen?
Tell me.
They will leave their jobs.
Mm-hmm. All right, and so the system will implode. The system as we have it now will implode.
No, the system will increase because what will happen, they'll leave their jobs because they can leave their jobs because everything is provided for. Remember, they can only leave their job if they are successful, if their community is successful on all levels so that everything is provided for. So if you're working in a factory or a mine or a dangerous place that you have to travel for 2 hours every day to go and sit and work in a horrible, stinking, dangerous environment, are you going to keep your job if you're earning a lot of money every month from working 3 hours a week in one of your community projects? Of course you're not going to keep that job.
Who's going to work in the mine?
Nobody. We don't need mines. Mines need to close down. And because we're going to have new technology, new material scientists, within the first year, our material scientists in our small town will be mixing graphene with hemp, with all kinds of silica or any quartz, whatever you want to imagine, creating new materials that are bio-friendly, that we can make as much of it as we can, are completely non-toxic, biodegradable, reusable, completely harmonious with nature, and we can create anything we want. We don't need iron, we don't need steel, we don't need any of that stuff that was shoved down our throats as part of the Industrial Revolution. That's all part of the slavery system.
What happens if, and I know I keep saying that word if, but what happens if we're in one of these communities, and bear in mind, I like the sound of this, okay? But we're in one of these communities, and my skill is the thing that I do here. It's not worth very much. It's just communication. It's hot air, really. It's writing. It's stuff like that. It's all nebulous kind of stuff, but that's what I've done all my life. What happens if the engineer down the road, who's a very bright person who can make things happen, says, my work is worth more than his. I should be getting a bigger slice of the cake.
Well, what do you eat more potatoes? Do you need a bigger bed? Well, what bigger slice of the cake do you want? How many beds do you need? How many potatoes can you eat in one day?
Well, you try telling him that.
Well, remember, this is not a free for all. This is a well-structured, organized system called contributionism. It's not a free for all where people can do what they want. So everybody needs to contribute 3 hours a week in one of the community projects. What you do with the rest of your time is entirely up to you, which means in a week of 168 hours in 1 week, you have 165 hours left to do whatever you please. And what people will choose to do if they have that free time is what makes them tick, what gives them joy, what they're good at, what makes them wake up with a smile on their face. And they're going to start, whether you're a horsey person, if you like breeding horses or riding horses, what you do with the horses will be a benefit to the community, right? Whether you are a person like you, whether you do want to do, you know, reporting and report on the success and what's happening in your town, people are going to love you because you're going to keep them informed as to what's happening in every aspect of their town and make them feel good about themselves. And people that make movies are going to be making documentaries, putting it out to the rest of the world, telling everybody how successful their town is. So there's a space for everyone.
Isn't that what they do in North Korea?
I don't know what they do in North Korea.
Well, they say an awful lot of good things about themselves in North Korea.
I'm not interested in what they're doing in North Korea. I'm interested in how we're going to change the world that I maneuver in and that thousands, if not millions of people are now aware of. And we have not just, We're not just talking about it. We have started to do it. So that's what gives me the confidence that this is happening already. It's not just hot air that we're blowing.
Well, can I just say, for those people who will be saying, why is he knocking that nice Mr. Tellinger down? I'm with you on a lot of this. Let me just say that very clearly. Last what if, and we're going to have to wrap it up for now, but I want to talk about this again, if you can possibly make the time. I'd love to, and maybe we can do this on the radio. If Community A is massively successful and everybody in it's doing really well, everybody's doing their 3 hours, and it is the most harmonious and marvelous place, what is to stop it from growing and taking over Community B, where people are perhaps not quite so committed?
That's exactly what it's intended to do. Ooh. This is why it creates a domino effect. And within a very short space of time, the one small town will change the world. Not can, but it will change the world. Once you've got this implemented in a town, it affects and infects with the success model all the neighboring towns. Contributionism devours capitalism. It's as simple as that.
Well, good luck, Michael. On every possible level, I mean those words. And, you cannot be faulted for your supreme enthusiasm, which you've displayed every time we've spoken, once in person and all the other times. And I mean it. Good luck, Michael. Please keep in touch with me about all of this. And I know that you've had a really long day today. So to be able to speak with the enthusiasm that you've just spoken is a mark of you and what you do. So many, many thanks.
Well, thank you, Howard. It's always great talking to you. Yeah, I love your enthusiasm as well. So you've been a great voice for sharing knowledge, information, and you need to carry on doing what you're doing so that people like me can get our message across to the many thousands of people, or hundreds of thousands, or millions of people that find you and listen to you and the information that you carry across. So thank you for talking to me.
Well, thank you. And one thing I've always wanted to get across is that there is such wisdom in Africa that people up here dismiss or ignore or don't even bother referencing at all. And they need to kind of wake up and smell the coffee here, because, things are changing. If people want to read about you, Michael, what's that website?
So very simple. My website is michaeltellinger.com. And then go to Ubuntu Planet, ubuntuplanet.org. Go sign up, join our movement. Tell everybody you know we're growing rapidly. We've got, obviously, we're pushing the one small town philosophy and strategy. But what we are going to be pushing very hard this year is the one small gathering, where we grow weekly and monthly gatherings of people that want to meet like-minded people, share knowledge and information, meet enthusiastic people, stop being negative, and plan a strategy as to how, what is the next mayor that they can go and approach, or what piece of land can they use to create a one small farm or a one small project. So we got a one small town, one small farm, and a one small gathering approach in 2018, and it's starting to work really well already.
And when it comes to us up here, is that before or after Brexit? Michael, thank you so much. I really enjoyed that. And take care. Have a good rest of your day in South Africa.
Thanks, Howard. You too.
Michael Tellinger, and I will put a link to him and his work on my website, theunexplained.tv. And yes, I was fascinated by all of that, and I hope you were too. We'll get him on again here at some point to discuss these matters even further. More great guests to come here on The Unexplained as we move through 2018. So until next we meet, my name is Howard Hughes. I am in London. This has been The Unexplained. And please stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.